Jimmy were indeed her friend, she'd know what he looked like. Then why the ruse? She has a daughter of marriageable age. She nodded at the girl of 17 or so, who observed her mother out of the corner of her eye. They probably think Jack is a potential suitor, and the mother wants to be the first of her acquaintance to engage his interest. Keep listening. A shop girl approached, and Sylvia left me to be shown some hats at the back. I continued to watch Jack from beneath lowered lashes as I strolled between tables and hat stands. "You must be new to London, Mr. Langley," the woman said. "I've never seen you at any of the parties."
"I come to the city rarely, and only for business. I live in Hertfordshire, madam, with my uncle, August Langley."
A small crease connected her thin eyebrows. "That name sounds familiar. Where in Hertfordshire is your uncle's house, Mr. Langley? Perhaps that will refresh my memory."
"Frackingham House, near Harborough."
The woman's mouth pursed, as if she'd tasted something bitter. "Oh." She stepped away. "Good day to you, sir. My apologies for mistaking you for my friend. I can see now that you're nothing like Mr. Bellamy." She scuttled away and rejoined her daughter. "Mama," the girl whispered, "what's wrong?" The mother's voice was too low for me to hear her entire answer. The only words I could make out were, "Freak House." It was enough to explain her change in behaviour. Sylvia bought two hats in different shades of grey, and Jack carried the boxes out to the carriage and bundled them into the storage compartment with the others.
"Satisfied now, cousin?"
he asked Sylvia, as he settled opposite us on the seat. "Why are those women looking at us like we have two heads?" she said. I followed her gaze to the woman who'd questioned Jack and her daughter. They did indeed eye us from beneath their hat brims. "You were right about them," I told her. The mother wished to throw her daughter into Jack's path at any parties he might deign to attend. Jack rolled his eyes. "Yes, but why does she look as if she wants to run in the other direction to get away from us?" She narrowed her eyes at him. "What did you say to her?"
"Nothing," he said. "I gave her my name and place of residence. That's all."
Sylvia flounced back into the seat and crossed her arms. "How could you?" One corner of his mouth lifted, and her glare sharpened. "It's not amusing."
"I'm sorry,"
he said, sobering.
"I know it matters to you. I just wish you knew that they don't matter to me."
"What doesn't?" I said. "I don't understand. Whenever we go anywhere, which isn't often, Jack likes to tell people where we're from."
"It's called introducing myself, Syl. It's what people do when they meet."
"Yes, but can't you lie? Why do you have to tell them we're from Frackingham?"
"Because we are. The sooner you come to accept that, the happier you'll be."
"I doubt I could ever be happy to be associated with Freak House." Jack looked quite unnerved by her misery.
"Those people aren't for the likes of us," he said quietly.
"You shouldn't let them bother you," I said to her. "I agree with Jack. They don't seem like the sort of people you'd want to be friends with anyway." "That's easy for you to say. You and Jack are the freaks. I'm the freak by association. It's not fair." Her remark cut through me to the bone. I'd thought we'd become friends of sorts, But to say something so offhandedly callous proved there was still an ocean of differences between us. She was right, of course. I wasn't normal. Now I knew I was also very much alone. We arrived at Claridge's, and instead of coming inside with us, Jack bid us farewell.
"I'm going for a walk," he said.
"Where to?" Sylvia asked.
"Nowhere in particular. I need to stretch my legs."
"You've been walking all day."
"You object to me wanting to spend some time alone."
"Do whatever you want," she said huffily, striding off. I watched Jack go and chewed my lip. Should I follow him? If I did, would I learn more about him? I knew he was going to see Patrick, the person he suspected of breaking into Frackingham House, and I desperately wanted to find out who Patrick was and how Jack knew him. But I would have to follow him surreptitiously, and that meant being alone, more or less. I didn't consider myself a fearful person in general, but being on my own in a city the size of London set my nerves on edge. What if I lost Jack? What if I wandered into one of the less appealing areas I'd seen on our journey in?
"Lady Violet," called a familiar voice.
"Mr. Gladstone," I said as he came up to me. "Are you here to see me?"
"I am. May we talk?"
Down the street, Jack turned the corner, unaware of the medical student's presence. I made up my mind then and there. "Yes, excellent. Let's talk and walk at the same time. I have a mind to be out and about in this fresh air." He pulled a face.
"It's cold and growing dark."
"The lamps will be lit soon. I've always wanted to see London in the evening." I hooked my arm through his and hailed one of the Claridge's footmen hovering nearby. "Please inform Miss Langley that I've gone for a walk," I told him. To Mr. Gladstone, I said, "Quickly now, a swift walk is a good one." We rounded a corner, and I breathed a sigh of relief when I saw Jack up ahead. "Now, what is it you wanted to say to me, Mr. Gladstone?" Chapter 8.
"Lady Violet, is everything all right?"
Mr. Gladstone asked.
"You seem distracted."
"Just enjoying the walk. And please, let's not be so formal with one another. You may call me Violet." "Hannah," part of me shouted inside. I so wished to hear my real name again.
"In that case, you may call me Samuel."
Up ahead, Jack turned another corner. He walked swiftly, his strides long and purposeful. He didn't look back, and since it was becoming darker, we didn't need to hide. London's ever-present fog had already begun to settle in the dim depths of the alley, and it wasn't yet 4 o'clock. "Now, Samuel, what is it you wanted to talk to me about?"
"May we slow down?"
"No."
"Right."
He cleared his throat.
"Ever since you left Dr. Werner's rooms this morning, I haven't been able to stop thinking about you. I mean, your situation."
"Oh?" Jack turned another corner, and I sped up. I didn't want to lose him when we'd gotten this far.
"I think there may be another possibility to explain the blocking of your memories."
"Something other than a traumatic event? That is a relief." Indeed it was. I'd felt unnerved at the thought ever since he'd suggested it.
"Yes, but..."
He sighed.
"There's no easy way to tell you this. Someone may have deliberately tampered with your mind."
I stumbled, but with our arms linked, he was able to steady me. I stared up at him, my heart in my throat, beating like a drum. You'd better tell me what you mean.
We'll lose him if we don't keep walking, he said.
Pardon? He nodded in the direction of Jack.
Mr. Langley, we are following him, aren't we?
I pressed a hand to my head. Yes, I murmured, but this is important.
Then I'll tell you as we go. Come on.
I allowed him to lead me a few paces until I regained my wits. Samuel, tell me, please. What do you mean someone has tampered with my mind? Do you mean they've blocked off my memories on purpose?
May have blocked them. It's simply another possibility. One I didn't want to mention in front of Dr. Werner.
Why not?
Because he doesn't believe in it.
Believe in what? Samuel, you're not making sense. He huffed out of breath.
This is complicated, but I'll try to explain it. I've been able to hypnotise people ever since I can remember. Medical professionals like Dr. Werner have had to learn to do it, but I've always had the ability.
Really? Have you been hypnotising unsuspecting people since you were a child? He gave me a crooked smile.
Yes. Much to my parents' dismay, until...
He cleared his throat.
Never mind. Suffice it to say, I learned not to use hypnosis unless the subject agreed. I decided the best way to use my ability was to become a neurologist and hypnotise patients in a professional capacity.
When did you discover that memories could be blocked? Is that something you can do?
Do you always ask so many questions?
Yes. The Langleys find it irritating too. He chuckled.
Come on, walk faster. He's going into that alley.
Jack had indeed entered a narrow street through an archway. We paused at its entrance. Then, when we saw him walking up ahead, we continued on. The houses changed. They were smaller and squashed together like cold, ragged children. Their windows and stoops, however, were clean, and those people still outside appeared to have somewhere to go, although there was hollow resignation on their faces. I drew closer to Samuel.
Are you all right, Violet? Do you want to turn back?
No. I expected we would be entering one of the worst areas of London.
This isn't the worst, he said quietly. Not by far.
If he were afraid, he didn't show it. He did seem particularly alert, scanning to left and right as we walked. Go on, Samuel. Tell me about purposefully blocking memories using hypnosis.
I stumbled upon the process in my teens. I was, experimenting with my abilities. And unfortunately, instead of hypnotising someone and making him think he was a woman, I blocked his memory of the entire day.
You tried to make a man think he was a woman, I giggled. You can do that.
There are many things a hypnotist can do while a subject is in a hypnotised state. That was one of my favourites when I was about 15.
How wicked of you!
I can assure you, my wickedness is in the past. These days I mostly cure ladies of melancholy or hysteria,
he said with a sigh.
You are a welcome change.
The street narrowed again, and the air grew dank, dark. Very little light filtered through the fog from the setting sun. There were few gas lamps, and even fewer of them were lit. Those that were lit glowed in the miasma like disembodied orbs. So what happened after you tried to hypnotize that man into thinking he was a woman?
When the subject awoke from his hypnosis, something very odd happened. He became a narcoleptic.
What?
Shh. Up ahead, Jack stopped. Samuel pulled me into a recessed doorway as Jack turned. My face pressed into Samuel's chest. I could feel his chin above my head, his heart thumping against my ear, despite the layers of clothing. It beat in time to the rhythm of my blood. He peered round the edge of the brickwork.
He's walking again.
We followed. Did your subject fall asleep at particular moments, or did the narcoleptic episodes occur with no pattern whatsoever?
He fell asleep at moments of great excitement.
How interesting. Does he still suffer from the episodes?
No.
Did you cure him?
I tried, but couldn't. He was cured in another way.
How? A few heartbeats passed before he answered.
It's not something I can discuss with a lady.
Samuel, you have to tell me. Whatever it is, I can assure you I won't be shocked. He cleared his throat.
Very well. Yes, it took another event of great excitement to cure him. Excitement of a male nature.
You mean when he was aroused by a woman? He made a strangled sound that I took as embarrassed affirmation. I do believe you're blushing, Samuel. As was I, rather fiercely. Despite my attempt to sound worldly, I was very far from it. I knew in theory what happened between a man and a woman when they grew aroused, thanks to a book our biology tutor smuggled in one day while Miss Levine wasn't looking. But my practical knowledge was nil.
Well, he said, so, in conclusion, whatever produces narcolepsy within you is the very thing that will cure you of it, albeit in a larger dose. My subject fell asleep when he was aroused, but it was the same emotion that ended his narcolepsy once and for all.
A larger dose?
My subject was cured by excessive, stimulation. There happened to be two women with him at the time.
Two? Is that even possible? Poor Samuel ran his finger inside his collar and stretched his neck.
Please don't ask any more questions. There are some things a lady shouldn't hear.
What about a lady's companion?
You need to expose yourself to whatever emotion it is that sets off your narcolepsy, he said. Do you know what it is?
Fear, I think.
Good. All you need now is to experience heightened terror, and you may be cured.
That's something to look forward to, I said dryly.
Who do you think did this to you? You must know someone capable of hypnosis. Someone with the natural talent for it, like me. Not learned, as in Dr. Werner's case. Do you know who that might be?
No, nor do I know why they would do this to me.
Tell me about the Langleys. Perhaps it was one of them.
It wasn't. I've only known them a few days, and I've been a narcoleptic all my life.
Indeed. What about your family?
I'm not in contact with them at the moment. When I see them again, I'll ask.
A good idea.
You say Dr. Werner doesn't believe in this kind of blockage, as put there by a hypnotist. That means you must have discussed it with him at some point.
I have, but he tried to replicate it, and it didn't work. When I suggested that only natural hypnotists could do it, he scoffed and said there were no such people.
How odd.
Very. I don't know of others, you see, and have heard of none. You don't know what it's like to be the only one who suffers from something. How wrong he was. You're the first person I've mentioned my ability to, he said. I have to say, it's such a relief that you're not laughing at me, or have run screaming in the other direction.
I wouldn't do that. I may need you if I fall asleep out here. We hurried after Jack, getting further and further into the depths of London's web of alleys.
I'm beginning to think we ought to turn back, Samuel said. This part of London isn't safe, particularly after dark.
We had indeed walked into an even grimier part of the city. The cobbled streets were covered in some sort of slippery sludge. I had to hold on to Samuel's arm, or I'd slip over. A sickly smell mingled with the fog that hung in the air. Dirty children's faces peered out of windows at us, their eyes sunken, their hair matted. Men and women sat or lay on the filthy ground, their hands buried in their too thin clothes, their feet and heads bare, despite winter being in the air. One or two clutched my hem as I passed, begging for food, and Samuel quickly obliged with a few coins, until he had no more to give. I clung to his arm and slowed. You're right. We should go back. Just as I said it, Jack stopped to talk to a boy shivering in a recessed doorway. He nodded, and the lad disappeared inside, only to return a moment later with a tall man. A man with a big, crooked nose and a scar over one eye. He clamped Jack on the shoulder, and Jack nodded a greeting. The thin lad scampered back inside and shut the door. I looked around for closer hiding places and spotted an arched bridge nearby. If we stood beneath it, we would be able to hear their conversation. "Keep your head down and stay close to the walls where it's darker," I said to Samuel.
"What if he sees us?"
"He won't harm us, if that's your concern. I am quite sure of that."
"He won't harm you. I doubt any feelings of mercy will extend to me."
"Are you afraid of him?"
"No. I just don't want to have to fight him. I put those days behind me when I started at University College."
"You were a fighter?"
"I got into scrapes regularly, and found the need to defend myself."
He put a hand to his hat to shield his face. It didn't matter, because Jack was too intent on his conversation to notice us. We tucked ourselves into the shadows of the archway and strained to hear.
"I confess," said Jack's companion, "it were me that done it. You gonna drag me off to the Rozzers, then?"
He sounded amused, cocksure.
"I should. Or better yet, I'll take you home with me. August Langley will have a fitting punishment in mind."
"Stop speaking like a toff."
The man, Patrick, I assumed, wiped his nose with the back of his hand.
"You ain't one of them. Never will be. Think you're all high and mighty living in the big house while we starve down here in this rat pit."
He hawked and spat on the ground at Jack's feet. Jack didn't move, but his shoulders stiffened slightly, and his hand closed into fists at his sides.
"What did you take from his rooms?"
"Oh, I don't know, do I? Just some papers. I was told where to find them, and find them I did."
"Papers about what?"
"That's some kind of joke. You know I can't read."
Jack tipped his head back, sighed.
Who are you working for?
I can't tell you that now, Jack-o'-lantern. Ain't none of your business no more.
It is my business. I live there.
Patrick snorted a harsh laugh.
And what right have you got to live there, eh? You think that man's your uncle? Because I ain't so sure you're any more a Langley than me.
Jack shoved Patrick in the chest, slamming him back against the door with such force that I heard a crack of wood. Beside me, Samuel bristled, and his hand took mine, reassuring me that he would not let anything happen to me. I appreciated the gesture, although I wasn't scared. Jack's anger was directed at Patrick, and the man looked terrified. He held up his hands in surrender.
Sorry, Jack. I meant no harm.
Who you been saying that to?
Jack's voice was a low growl, just audible through the invading fog.
You don't know me no more,
he went on.
Got that, Patrick. Now, tell me who paid you to take them papers from Langley.
Patrick shook his head.
Can't say.
Jack slammed him back against the door again. The window nearby opened, and a young boy's head popped out.
What's that racket?
When Jack glared at him, the lad ducked back inside and slammed the window shut.
Tell me, Patrick,
Jack snarled.
I ain't got time for this.
I can't.
Said he'd kill me if I told he did. I'll bloody kill you if you don't.
Two sparks flared in the darkness, and one landed on Patrick's jacket. He yelped and patted it, and it quickly fizzled out.
What was that?
Samuel whispered.
Did those sparks come from Jack's hands? Is he holding some sort of ignition device? Whoa,
said Patrick, breathing hard.
Careful, Jack-o'-lantern. It's just business. It ain't personal.
It is to me.
Jack's voice was once more cultured, gentlemanly, but it was no less threatening.
They hang thieves.
You wouldn't turn me in.
Patrick's voice trembled.
We was friends once. Don't that mean something now?
Not if you cross me. Tell me who you work for, and I'll leave you alone. If you don't...
He patted the burned patch on Patrick's jacket.
I may not be able to control my temper next time.
Patrick's swallow could be heard clear across the street.
Don't tell him I told you.
I won't.
I don't know his name.
Jack's hands glowed, but no sparks shot from them.
You must know something. Where can I find him? What does he look like?
I met him down at the ball. Spoke like a toffee, did, and had white hair. And only one arm.
One arm?
Aye, and a shiny, pale face.
Jack nodded.
Anything else?
Nope. You go into the Rozzers?
Not unless you do it again. Tommy begged me to keep your name to myself, for old time's sake.
Patrick grinned.
Them old times were a laugh, weren't they, Jack-o'-lantern, when you used to set stuff on fire?
Don't.
Jack bit off.
Don't tell a soul about those days. Understand? My charity extends only so far.
Patrick nodded quickly.
Speaking of charity...
He jerked his head at the window where the lad had peeked out.
Winter's almost here, and there's more coming every day than I know what to do with.
I'll send money and warm clothes as soon as I can. You only had to send word, Patrick. No need to take to thieving again.
Once a thief, always a thief, eh, Jack-o'-lantern? We can't change who we are deep down.
Jack stared at the window.
Don't lead any of those children along that path. And don't steal from Langley again.
He strode toward us, and Samuel and I ducked further into the shadows as he passed. When I looked up again, Patrick had gone inside. The street was cold and quiet, the darkness almost complete, except for the single lamp fading in and out near Patrick's door.
"Let's go," Samuel said. "Walk fast, and don't make eye contact with anyone. We might just get out of here without being accosted."
I allowed him to lead me away as I considered what I'd just learned. One thing I was sure about now. Jack hadn't been involved in the theft of the papers from Langley. But I was even more certain that he was trying to deceive his so-called uncle by pretending to be his heir. As Patrick had said, Jack wasn't a Langley. Someone reached out of the shadows and jerked me to a stop. I screamed, and a hand clamped over my mouth. It stank, and I gagged into the palm. The other hand held a blade to my throat. Its cool metal bit into my skin, but didn't cut. Samuel stopped too.
"Let her go," he said.
His voice was steady, commanding. If he were afraid, he didn't show it. I, on the other hand, quivered like jelly.
"Give me your money, sir, and she won't come to no harm."
"I haven't got any," Samuel said. "I gave it all away."
Brittle laughter filled my ear. Foul breath made me gag. I tried to shove the man off, but his grip tightened.
"God, oh God, oh God!"
"Then I want your coat," he said.
Samuel removed his coat, and the attacker let go of my mouth to take it. But instead of handing it over, Samuel threw it. The man caught it, but he lowered the knife in that brief moment of confusion, and I ducked out of the way. Samuel stepped up and punched him in the nose. Blood sprayed over the coat and cobbles, but thankfully not on me. Samuel grabbed my hand. We ran until we were out of the slum and back on the main street. We paused for breath within the circle of light cast by a lamp. I put a hand to my chest and sucked in air. Samuel gripped my shoulders and searched my face.
"Are you all right, Violet? Are you hurt?"
"No, I'm fine. Thank you, Samuel. You saved me."
His fingers kneaded my shoulder, but I got the feeling it was as much to reassure himself that I was unharmed than to comfort me.
"I'm glad I was able to help."
I felt sick to my stomach. It was my fault entirely. He had only agreed to accompany me because I'd insisted. What had I been thinking?
"I'm so sorry, Samuel. I didn't know it would be like that. Those people, they're so desperate."
"Starvation does that."
"I should have known. I've read the stories of Mr. Dickens."
He laughed and patted my hand.
"Then you are indeed a woman of the world."
We walked off in what I assumed was the direction of Claridge's, but in truth, I couldn't be certain. The fog had become so thick it shrouded the entire street, and I could see no landmarks, let alone recognize them. The clip-clop of hooves and the rattle of wheels on the road signaled that a vehicle had gone past, but it could have been a spectral carriage for all I knew.
It was nowhere to be seen. Behind us, footsteps echoed. I turned, but could see no one. The footsteps continued. Had Jack doubled back and now followed us? Or had someone been following the entire time and I'd been too distracted to notice?
"I've just had a thought," Samuel said, apparently oblivious to the footsteps.
"Oh?" I looked back over my shoulder, but the tap-tap of shoes on the pavement had ceased. "What about?" If it were about Jack, I already had a response in mind. I might not know everything about him, but I didn't want to divulge his fire-starting secret to Samuel. Not yet.
"Do you recall how you said your narcolepsy may be caused by fear?"
"Yes."
"I don't think it is, or you would have suffered an episode just now. You were terrified, weren't you?"
"More than I've ever been in my life." It was quite true, I realised. I'd not even been that afraid when I woke up in the carriage after Jack abducted me.
"Yet you didn't fall asleep."
"Good Lord, you're right."
"That means it has another trigger."
"Yes," I muttered. "Yes, it does." We reached the front door of Claridge's, and a footman opened it for me. Before I had a chance to thank Samuel for his help and say goodbye, Sylvia barreled up and threw her arms around my neck.
"Thank goodness you're back," she said on a small sob. "I've been so worried."
"I sent word that I was going for a walk," I said. She held me at arm's length.
"Yes, but I knew you didn't know your way around London. And I've heard such dreadful things about girls getting lost and never being seen again."
She smothered another sob with her hand.
"I had a dim hope that you'd gone with Jack, but then he returned without you. We've been out of our minds with worry. Jack was just on his way out again to search for you."
Jack stood to one side in the foyer of the hotel. A desolate, bleak shadow passed across his face before he turned away, presenting me with a view of his back. He drew in several deep breaths, and his fingers gripped the marble tabletop, his knuckles white.
"I'll speak to him," Samuel said.
"No," Sylvia and I cried. "Jack's temper is not to be trifled with," I added.
"He's not angry," Sylvia said, blinking at me. "He's as relieved as I am to have you back safely."
"In that case, perhaps I should be the one to speak to him." But I didn't get the chance. He strode off and up the stairs, taking two at a time. I sighed. "Perhaps tomorrow."
"Where did you go?"
Sylvia asked. "For a walk with Samuel." She lifted a brow.
"Samuel? I see. Well, I admit I thought a man of your profession would have better manners than to go walking in the dark with a young lady. I must admit, I'm very disappointed in you, Mr. Gladstone."
"Don't blame him," I said. "It was all my fault. I insisted."
"But why? Where did you go?"
"Nowhere in particular. I needed some fresh air."
"Fresh air? In London?"
Her gaze flicked to Samuel, then back to me again.
"I see."
"I'd better be on my way."
Samuel bowed to both of us.
"Good night, ladies. I'm glad I could be of service, Lady Violet."
"You were. Thank you, Samuel, from the bottom of my heart. Goodbye." He grinned and walked out the door. I hooked my arm through Sylvia's, and we headed for the stairs. "Are you quite sure Jack isn't angry?" I asked. "He looked rather tempestuous just now." "If he were angry, he'd have sparks spitting from his fingertips." "I suppose so. Then why did he storm off without speaking to me?"
"Can't you see? He was sick with worry. Then you returned, and it was obvious you'd spent the last little while walking with a man in the dark. A man that wasn't him."
"Oh." But there'd been something more in his eyes as he gazed at me. Not jealousy, but bitter disappointment, too.
Chapter 9. Jack rode with Olson on the driver's seat on the way back to Hertfordshire, not inside the carriage cabin with Sylvia and me. I saw him only briefly when we arrived at Frackingham, and it wasn't until the next day when we were summoned to his uncle's rooms that we spoke. "Jack, may we talk?" I said, as he held the door open for me. "I don't like this." His jaw became a little less rigid, his eyes a little less vivid in colour.
"I hate it too. You and that Gladstone fellow."
"It was just a walk, Jack. Nothing more. I'm not interested in him in that way." The muscles in his face relaxed. Then,
"Not now,"
Langley interrupted.
"Both of you, come."
He sat facing us, bollard at his side, like a guard dog. But it was the floor that caught my attention. Several small blackened scorch marks pockmarked the wood. They looked like they'd been put there by sparks that had been quickly doused. Jack must have done it when he and his uncle had argued over me being kept prisoner in the house a few days earlier. It was a shocking reminder that his temper was never far away, and of the damage it could cause.
"Is there anything you want to tell me, Jack?"
Langley asked.
"The hypnotist did indeed say Violet's memories were blocked, but he could do nothing to clear it," Jack said. "It was a wasted journey, I'm afraid. Sylvia, however, might say differently."
I smiled, and he winked at me. It was such a relief to be friends again.
"Nothing else?"
Langley asked. At Jack's shrug, he added,
"Is there something more you should be telling me?"
"No."
Langley heaved a great sigh. His face was pale and pinched, the wrinkles fanning out from the corners of his eyes deeper.
"After everything I've done for you, everything I've given you, you lie to my face."
Jack's lips parted, and I heard him expel a small hiss.
"What are you talking about?"
His voice grew dark, ominous. He no longer looked at his uncle, but at me. I frowned, shrugged, but a sense of dread settled in my chest. I knew what this was about. We both did.
"You saw someone while you were in London,"
Langley said.
"An old friend of yours."
"And?"
"Don't treat me like a fool."
He thumped his fist on the arm of his wheelchair.
"He stole my papers, and you weren't going to tell me. Or the police."
"I..."
"Were you?"
A muscle in Jack's cheek pulsed.
"No."
"Why not?"
"I don't want him to get into trouble."
"It's not for you to make that decision."
Langley's shout reverberated around the room, and I jumped. I took a step back, not wanting to be anywhere near this man and his explosive temper. Jack went very still,
then slowly curled his fingers into a fist, but not before I noticed the tips glowing.
"Patrick is not the one you want," he said.
"I know that."
He took a few breaths before saying,
"I'm sure you do."
Langley's nostrils flared.
"Dismissed, both of you."
I hurried to the door, but Jack didn't move.
"What are you going to do about Patrick?"
"He's a thief. He'll get what he deserves."
Jack leaned forward and clamped his hands down on the wheelchair arms, pinning Langley's hands. Bollard grabbed his shoulder and tried to pull him off, but Jack snarled at him and the servant backed away. The expression on Langley's face changed from rage to horror to fear.
"Let go!" he cried. "My hands!"
Jack stepped back, and Langley plunged his hands into a basin of water that Bollard had retrieved from the table near the window. Langley's eyelids fluttered shut in relief. I covered my gasp and stared at Jack. Sparks flew from his fingertips, and Bollard stamped on them before they could catch a light. "Jack," I whispered. He seemed not to have heard me. His chest rose and fell with his seething anger, and he glared at his uncle.
"Whatever you've done to Patrick, undo it. He's a pawn, and those children need him. If you don't, I won't remain here any longer."
He didn't wait to see if Langley agreed. He turned and fixed a glare on me that had me more confused than ever. His rage vanished almost instantly, replaced with such wretchedness that I wanted to reach for him. He blinked rapidly and hurried out of the room. And that's when I realized he blamed me for telling his uncle about his visit to Patrick. I searched for Jack everywhere. After checking with Olson at the stables, I found him at the Abbey ruins, his horse grazing nearby. From a distance, he cut a lonely figure against the grey sky. He looked up when I approached, and for a brief moment, I was afraid he'd walk off in the other direction. But he didn't. He did, however, watch me with frightening intensity from beneath half-closed lids. "You're still mad," I said. He folded his arms and tucked away his hands, but not before I saw the pink flesh on his fingertips. "I thought you said you could control your anger." I nodded at his hands. "And that?"
"I can."
Which meant he'd wanted to hurt Langley. And me? I swallowed heavily. He unfolded his arms, and his shoulders sagged.
"You don't need to fear me, Violet. Not ever. I wouldn't deliberately hurt you."
"Then..."
"Why did you do it?"
he asked.
"Why did you tell him where I went?"
"So you did see me?"
"You and Gladstone. I lost you on the way home, however. So tell me, why?"
"I didn't tell him anything. What could I possibly gain?"
"Perhaps you're still angry at me for kidnapping you."
"I'm not. How could you think such a thing after..." "After the connection we'd made. Why didn't you tell me you'd seen me?"
"I hoped you'd talk to me of your own accord, but you didn't. And when August confronted me just now, I assumed you'd gone straight to him."
He blew out a measured breath.
"I'm sorry, Violet. Forgive me."
I nodded. How could I not when he peered at me through the hair that had flopped over his eyes? He looked like a scolded puppy.
So if it wasn't you, he said, it must have been Gladstone.
What reason would Samuel have to tell Langley? And how would he have gotten word to Frackingham so quickly?
So it's Samuel now, is it?
I call you Jack. I wanted to tell him that it was different between us, that the bond we'd forged so quickly made everything different. He did not.
Why was he there at all?
He asked instead. I decided it was better to be honest with him than skirt the issue. Well, partially honest. He wanted to tell me that my memory block may have been deliberately put there by a hypnotist. His jaw dropped.
Who would do such a thing?
I told him what Samuel had told me about his own natural gift for hypnosis, and how he'd stumbled upon the ability by accident.
What did Dr. Werner have to say about this suggestion?
Jack asked. He doesn't believe natural hypnotists exist, and so doesn't endorse the notion of deliberately blocking memories. That's why Samuel came to me at Claridge's. He wanted to speak to me away from Dr. Werner. He leaned against the stones that formed one of the crumbling arches.
It sounds too extraordinary to be true.
So does shooting sparks from your fingers.
Can Gladstone remove this block for you?
No. He thinks it can only be done through stimulating the same emotion that triggers my narcolepsy. And my fire starting. A very strong stimulation, that is. More than usual. What does that mean?
It means that I'm not sure I entirely trust Samuel Gladstone. In many ways, the ability to hypnotize someone is far more dangerous than our talent. I admit that I don't like it.
Don't like his talent, or don't like him? His gaze slid away.
They're one and the same.
So you still think he's the one who told your uncle?
Who else could have? I want to believe it wasn't you,
he added in a whisper. It wasn't. I give you my word.
Then it must have been him. A fast rider carrying a message would have easily reached Frackingham before us.
He pushed off from the stones.
We should return to the house and resume your training.
Is there any point now that we know about the blockage?
We can only keep trying.
He took his horse's reins and we walked together back to the house. The grey clouds hung low overhead and the air felt charged, thick, although that could have been due to the silence between us. When I could stand it no longer, I said, "How do you know Patrick?"
"I just do."
"But..."
"Do you need to know everything, Violet?"
We'd reached the point where we needed to go our separate ways. He directed his horse off to the stables, and I headed for the main house. "Yes," I wanted to tell him. "Yes, I do need to know everything about you." Even though I couldn't tell him everything about myself. Not yet. One day, however, he would know it all, and I would know every detail of Jack Langley's life, even if it meant finding out things I didn't like. We trained for the remainder of the day. Jack tried various techniques to help me feel the heat through my body, as he put it. Nothing worked, of course, and we ended our session at dinner time. He seemed quite frustrated by our lack of progress, and I admit I was growing anxious about telling him the truth. The longer I lied, the harder it would be to admit that I wasn't Violet Jameson,
and the worse his reaction would be. I resolved to speak to Langley after dinner and confront him over his motives for kidnapping me. His reactions to a few direct questions should prove once and for all if he was lying about his intentions. I dressed for dinner and met Sylvia and Jack in the dining room. She looked particularly lovely in a crimson and white gown with bows down the front, and I told her so. "This old thing," she said with a crinkle of her nose. "I'm so tired of it. Do you want it?" "Thank you, but it's not my colour."
"Perhaps not," she said, sitting. "I can't wait for our new dresses to arrive. Pity we don't have anything to wear them to except dinner with Jack."
"Something wrong with dining with me?"
he asked, as he too sat.
"You're hardly an excellent catch for either of us. Violet is the daughter of an earl, and I am more particular. No offence meant."
"And how could I take offence when you put it so eloquently?"
It was difficult to tell if he were teasing or a little bitter. "Perhaps you ought to ask some neighbours to a dinner party," I said. Both Jack and Sylvia looked at me like I'd lost my mind.
"Dinner at Freak House," Sylvia said. "How they will be falling over themselves to attend."
"Why do they call this place Freak House? Do they know that Jack can start fires?"
"No," he said. "It's not that."
"It's Uncle August and Bollard."
Sylvia served herself from the dish of pheasant mandarin that Tommy offered her.
"One is mute, and the other is crippled, and reclusive."
"August hasn't courted either the neighbours or the villagers, so they distrust him,"
Jack said.
"By secluding himself in the house, he's turned himself into an object of curiosity and gossip. I'm sure the servants have gossiped about his temper and how he keeps to his rooms."
"And there's the house's past, of course," Sylvia said.
"It's past?" I asked. Jack cast a warning glare at Sylvia.
"I'm not sure we need to hear this now."
"Nonsense. There are rumours that 100 years or so ago, the then Lord Frackingham kept some of his offspring locked in the dungeon."
My stomach rolled.
Oh, how
familiar.
Horrid. Whatever for?
"They were imperfect," Jack said. "Due to centuries of inbreeding, it was said that most of the Frackingham children were born abnormal. Some with physical deformities, others mad or simple."
"Freaks," I whispered. Sylvia snorted as she picked at her pheasant.
"It's not true. There is no dungeon. I've searched everywhere. Of course, this house isn't as old as the stories. Who knows what the previous one on this site looked like? Perhaps it had a dungeon."
"The rumours have persisted, anyway," Jack said.
What a strange coincidence that I should be kept in an attic almost my entire life, only to be rescued, in a manner of speaking, and end up in a place where something similar occurred years earlier.